Good evening, Chicago. Welcome to the show. Tom Bevin, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, here with you on Chicago's talk leader, 89 WLS. Got a great show for you tonight. Lot to cover, not the least of which is the attack in Syria, which President Trump announced on Friday night, and the aftermath of that. We've also got James Comey. His book has come out. We had excerpts released earlier in the week. He's given his big interview this evening with ABC News, and a whole round of media interviews coming up in the coming days. And we're also going to talk about the exit of Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan is giving up his speakership, giving up his seat, going to leave Congress. We'll talk about what that means for this November, for the future of the Republican Party in general. So we have just a ton of material to cover, and we're going to start by obviously discussing Syria and the political implications of this attack. And I'm pleased to be joined by Ford O'Connell, who is a Republican strategist and a former senior campaign advisor to McCain Palin in 2008. Ford, thanks for spending some time with me tonight. Appreciate it.
Always great to be on with you, Tom.
All right, so let's talk about this. This was, you know, this is one of those things. When Trump first came into office, right, one of the first things he did, launched an attack after a chemical weapons attack by Syria, 57, 58, 59 Tomahawk missiles, you know, sort of reinforcing this idea that chemical weapons were beyond the pale. Just as much as a couple weeks ago, Trump was, you know, on his generals. He wanted to get out of Syria altogether. Then we had this chemical attack, and now we're back in, albeit with Great Britain and with the French. But this is something that his base is really, and that he's uncomfortable with. This is something he sort of promised he was not going to do. He was going to try and stay out of these kind of messes. But Ford, he's right back in it now. Where is this taking him, and where is it taking the country?
Well, for President Trump, he really sees the latest strike in Syria as something where the goal is to degrade Syria's use of chemical weapons. It's also to send a message to the world that people who use, you know, WMDs will be held accountable. And finally, it's about telling Russia, look, you are in charge of Syria. You got to clean up your act and control your sphere of influence. I don't think that this is a situation that President Trump wants to be in, but he also understands that if he doesn't take a strong stand right now, he's concerned about what else might pop up around the world.
Do you think, though, Ford, that this is enough to send a message? I mean, clearly, this was sort of a restrained attack. It was focused on, you know, their chemical weapons capabilities, but certainly is not going to do anything to, you know, undermine the Assad regime. You saw Bashar al-Assad was on television just now saying, you know, reinforcing the idea that he's still in control. Putin has come back and said, look, there are going to be, if any more attacks happen, there's going to be chaos unleashed in the Middle East. So did this actually send the message that Trump wanted and intended it to send?
Well, I think what Trump is trying to send is that he will show a willingness to use force to keep his enemies in check. But I do agree with you. I think that President Trump's worldview, at least when it comes to the Middle East, is that essentially the Middle East is lost and we need to be getting out of there. The question, though, is always, how do you balance this? I also think that there's a little bit of a fight within his White House between how exactly they should move forward in Syria. Obviously, to your point, James Mattis, the defense secretary, believes that this should have been a limited strike, and part of the reason why Mattis wanted a limited strike was he wanted to minimize civilian casualties. He also wanted to make sure that Russia and Iran did not further engage and retaliate. But then on the flip side, you have someone like Ambassador John Bolton who would like to see this to be used as something that helps bleed the resources of Iran and Russia. You're seeing a little tension within the White House, but they're hewing more to Trump's instincts, which is we need to get out of the Middle East, but we need to make sure that everyone understands that, you know, when we take action, we mean business.
You mentioned John Bolton. So he just started as National Security Advisor, and you've got Mike Pompeo, who his confirmation hearings are going to be coming up imminently in the Senate for Secretary of State. And there's been a lot of talk forward about this restructuring of the Trump White House, particularly vis-a-vis foreign policy. And you mentioned this debate. Who do you think actually does this signal a shift in policy? Are we going to see sort of a harder line taken with respect to Iran and the Iran deal, with respect to North Korea, with respect perhaps even to China and certainly Russia. Is this a sort of changing of the guard, or is this just sort of some shuffling of personnel, but the policies aren't going to change dramatically?
Well, I think that this is a shuffling of personnel, but it's also going to obviously, look, when you have different people in the White House, it's eventually going to affect policy. I think that President Trump knows exactly where he wants to go. He wants to focus on China 24/7 because he understands that if you lose focus with the Chinese and you get dragged into the Middle East, that plays into China's hand. His goal is stopping China not only economically but militarily, because essentially he views them as the biggest threat to U.S. policy over the next 50 years. And what most people don't understand about China is just not building what I would call a New Jersey turnpike in the middle of the South China Sea to check folks economically and militarily. They are all over the world. They are anywhere from Southern Africa to South America to basically 90 miles off the coast of Florida. So he is concerned about the imperialistic ambitions of China. At the same time, though, he understands that the world is a dangerous place, and you have to always keep one eye on Iran and Russia and what it is they want to accomplish in the Middle East. And hopefully what you can do there is send a message about the use of WMDs more so than who the actors specifically are.
We're speaking with Ford O'Connell. He is a Republican strategist, former presidential campaign advisor, and frequent guest on Fox Business, which is where, Ford, you and I usually bump into each other in the Fox green room there in D.C. More broadly speaking, Ford, step back for a second, because I want to ask you about President Trump's job approval rating. In our Real Clear Politics average, we had a poll come out this morning. Washington Post had him at 44%, which was the highest he's been since his first 100 days in office. A conflicting number from the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll had him dropping from, I think, 43 down to about 39. But in our Real Clear Politics average, which, again, is a compilation of a number of polls, I think there are seven or eight in there right now, taken over the last 2 weeks, Trump is at about 42.5%. That is as high as he's been since May 9th of last year. This despite all of the Sturm und Drang over, you know, Stormy Daniels and James Comey and the turnover in the White House and whatnot. What do you make of this, Ford? Why is President Trump, when you might expect that, you know, he's taking a beating in the press, as he does pretty much all the time, why are his numbers rising now?
Well, I think that there's an understanding that the economy is improving. I think there was a Quinnipiac poll that also came out last week where the congressional generic ballot it favored the Democrats by 3, which is, I think, the lowest that we've seen in a year and a half. And one of the things that everyone is noticing, about 75% to 78% of Americans saying, you know, the economy is pretty good, and they're actually giving Donald Trump credit. And I think that he realizes that if he can continue showing economic improvement while doing things on a foreign stage that are limited but extremely presidential about putting America first, then he thinks potentially the Republicans could hold on to the House of Representatives. And for him, that is everything, because we know that if the Republicans lose the House of Representatives, essentially the Democrats are going to be sending up impeachment papers every week, from he should be fired to we don't like the way he breathes and sneezes this morning. So this is a very, very important thing, because President Trump knows that if he doesn't hold the House of Representatives, essentially the Trump agenda will be stalled for the foreseeable future, or at least until the 2020 reelection campaign, which would be the only time the Republicans would have a shot to actually control or at least be in charge of most of government.
You know, Ford, and I think given where there has been fairly widespread bipartisan approval of his action here in terms of the strike on Syria, there have been some naysayers, both from the left and the right, but I mean, everything I've kind of read, there seems to be. I saw Michael McFaul, former ambassador to Russia for President Obama, was endorsed this action, among many others. So I suspect this is something that, and again, he got a pretty decent bipartisan approval from the last strike. So I suspect, if anything, we might see his numbers tick a little bit higher. And as you mentioned, that's probably a good thing for Republicans, you know, sitting this far out from November. Obviously, still a lot of time between now and then.
Well, no, in terms of the politics of it, I think you're absolutely right. President Trump is receiving kudos from both sides of the aisle and from a lot of journalists across the country. I think they're kind of shocked that he was able to stick to his word about America first, try to limit civilian casualties, and deliver a message both to actors who use chemical weapons and Russia, who's in control, for all intents and purposes, of Syria. I think what's concerning on the other side of it, if you're President Trump, is if you turn on the TV or the radio, what is absolutely amazing is the number of what I call Beltway establishment folks on both sides of the aisle who are pushing him to further engage in Syria, something that his political instincts tell him not to do. Like, if you look at the Wall Street Journal, one of the things they say is, gee, Donald Trump needs a Syria strategy. No, Donald Trump does not need to get engaged any further into Syria than he already is, or America is, even before he came into office. He is right to focus on China, but he knows that we have to actually send a consistent message. And I think the takeaway from this was the first strike that we had in April of 2017 was about the delivery. This was about degrading, essentially, the capabilities to use chemical weapons and hopefully send a message going further. Hopefully we won't have to go back and do this, but as Nikki Haley pointed out, the ambassador to the UN, essentially Syria's done this about 50 times since April 13th when they promised to get rid of chemical weapons. So we don't know where it's going, but right now I will say this, Donald Trump is right to be cautious about this, and it's something that the American people agree with him on.
All right, we got to leave it there. Ford O'Connell, Republican strategist, thanks for your time tonight. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to be on the air with you, Tom.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we get back, Carl Cannon will join us to talk about James Comey and his book that's coming out, and the Michael Cohen raid, which took place last week, which upset and unsettled a lot of people, including the aforementioned Carl Cannon. Stick around. We're going to be right back.
Chris Plant. He's our embed in Washington. It's Chris Plant weekdays 9 till rush on WLS AM 890.
And we are back. Tom Bevin with you, joined on the phone by Carl Cannon, our Washington Bureau Chief Executive Editor. Carl, I normally have you batting cleanup for me, but moved you up in the lineup today because I want to talk to you about James Comey and Michael Cohen. But before we get to that, because you are a presidential historian and you have a lot of association with the Bush family, you covered him, your father covered some of the Bush folks as well. Quick news on Barbara Bush. There was a statement that was released earlier today, Carl, saying that Barbara Bush, who's now 92 years old, has decided not to seek additional medical treatment and will instead focus on comfort care. She's been battling bad health for a long time. It looks like she's ailing pretty badly. Any thoughts to that, Carl? Barbara Bush is she's been a fixture on the scene for and one of the most beloved first ladies in a long, long time.
Well, Tom, her name is Barbara Pierce. She was before she married Bush. We think her as the matron of the Bush clan now in our time, but she was a distant relative of Franklin Pierce, the president. She was royalty. And, you know, when she aged, she had this white hair, you know, and have a stolid build, and her husband, war hero, lanky guy, they seemed to age differently.
But, sure did.
Yeah, but if you look back at the picture, she was a movie star, beautiful, and she's always been tough and smart. And I have a soft spot for her, and I always have. We'll talk, I hope, a little bit about James Comey's memoir, but Barbara Bush wrote a memoir. It's a real book. It's not one of these quick and dirty, score-settling, narcissistic things. It's a real book. And there's some stories in there, and you realize what this family's been through. And, Tom, you're like me. You've got kids. They lost. Barbara Bush lost a daughter. And her name is Robin. And it's a child leukemia. We'd probably be able to cure it now. And that's when that hair went white. And she tells this very touching story in her book about when she just took to her bed, literally, and she had these other kids, and she had George, and he was the oldest. And one day, when she was going to have to pick herself up, the house was dark. They lived in Texas, and a little boy came, and she heard the knock on the door, and she heard her son, her oldest son, say, "No, I can't go out and play today. My mom needs me." And she realized she had to be there for the other kids. And she writes, it's very evocative. She got off of the bed, she pulled herself together, she raised these other kids and became this tough woman that we know today. So she, to me, she's always been an impressive person.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. All right, well, while with the time we have left, let's switch and talk about James Comey and his book, because it is the biggest news of the week, probably. This the release of his sort of the excerpts
so far,
and he's having his big interview with he did the interview. It was a 5-hour affair with George Stephanopoulos. It's airing tonight. But there will be plenty of more media to follow in the coming days across all sorts of platforms, MSNBC, CNN. Brett Baer is going to have him on Special Report on, I think, the 24th. But the book officially, I think, is published on the 19th. But we know a lot about it, Carl. And it's getting mixed reviews, I have to say. I mean, there are folks, your friend Lanny Davis, who attacks Comey from a different point of view. He thinks he cost Hillary Clinton the election. We have those sorts of people. We have Trump defenders. We have people who, and even not just Trump defenders, but people who look at James Comey and his conduct and him deciding to sort of, in the middle of this investigation, go for this tell-all, which apparently doesn't tell much that we don't already know about what went on between James Comey and Donald Trump. What do you make of this?
Well, you said mixed reviews. I haven't seen any good reviews of it yet, so I think you were being charitable. There was an old great book reviewer. He was a book reviewer in Baltimore and at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Michael Pakenham was his name, and he had a word for books like this thing that Comey's produced. He called them unbooks. They're not really books. In this case, this is a quickie thing where he, you know, psychoanalyzes Donald Trump and, you know, settles old scores and says, you know, that old Christian hymn, how great thou art. You know, James Comey is telling it's how great I art. And, and you know, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sort of dreading it because it's going to be a job requirement. It sounds like 300 and some pages of self-serving stories that there's no way to know if they're even true. And his self, he's so self-reverential. He notices this trait in Donald Trump and it bothers him, but he doesn't see the irony of how similar to Trump he is. You know, nothing's ever his fault. His motives are pure. He's so great. You know, everything he does. Here's a guy who botched the election, right? With this investigation, the odd timing of Hillary Clinton's emails. I assume he's going to say in the book that what he said publicly, which was that he had to release that second letter because he told the Congress that he would. But as Lanny Davis points out, he told the Congress no such thing. So I first became aware of Comey really when he and Mueller screwed up the anthrax case.
One of the things he does say in this book, Carl, which caught a lot of people by surprise and people have focused on, is he admits that he did this because the polls had Hillary Clinton ahead and it was almost her election was almost inevitable. And he thought, oh, my gosh, you know, what if she wins? She's likely to win. And then people find out after the fact that there was this investigation that we didn't inform people about. So he actually admits that the polls in the middle of that election drove his decision on what to do from a law enforcement perspective. And that is quite a stunning admission when you think about it.
I agree. And again, there's several levels to it. First of all, he's blaming other people, right? He's blaming the pollsters because Hillary didn't win. He's blaming Nate Silver by implication or whoever, right? These people, you and I weren't like that, but some of these famous prognosticators were sure that she couldn't win. But what he's saying, but this is what Lanny Davis accused him of in Lanny's book. And Tom, I went to lunch with that ass, Lanny, you can't really, I didn't even believe it was possible. Let's translate that. It's not just that he did the polls. What he's saying is that he did this because he knew she would win and there would be no price, you know, later. Well, she didn't win, and then there's a price. They stuck with it in this investigation. He manages to get himself fired by Trump. What's funny about that, you can realize how irritating he must have been to Trump, this sanctimonious guy who, you know, he's by his own admission, this came out earlier before the book, you know, every time he meets Trump, he runs back and types up his notes of the conversation. Now, you can only assume those are self-serving notes. But why would you think Trump – why wouldn't he think Trump sent some of this? You have employees, Tom. That's a level of sort of snarkiness and disloyalty and cover your hind end. It's just – why would you want a guy like that around you? So he fires him, and now Comey gets his revenge, I guess. Anybody who's been fired, maybe they can relate to this.
We'll see how much revenge there is in the end after all these things are done and this thing is picked over. Real quickly, Carl, just a couple of minutes left. I want to talk about your column that you wrote for the Orange County Register about this Michael Cohen raid. You and I were in Washington the night that it happened, and we talked about it. This bothered you a great deal.
It bothers me even more now, Tom, because they raid the lawyers, the president's lawyer. They get this judge to sign a warrant. They go in there, pick through his, and how long did it take? And they start leaking, the FBI or the Justice Department lawyers. They start leaking stuff that's in it about in Michael Cohen's files, in his files, that has nothing to do with Russia, with Trump, let alone Russia, other people, you know, who have been his clients. Are their affairs, and they're literally their extramarital affairs are out there for public consumption within 24, 36 hours. So the FBI is now, I would say, officially doing oppo research for the Democratic Party. And boy, I don't anybody who that if that doesn't bother you. You might rethink how partisan you really are, because that should bother anybody.
Well, it does seem that this was, I mean, you've seen Alan Dershowitz out there sounding the alarm bells here, and he's, you know, he keeps saying,
"I'm not a liberal left in America."
Yeah, I mean, he keeps saying, "I'm not defending Trump. I'm merely defending sort of, you know, the rule of law and civil liberties, and you know, not this standing up to sort of prosecutorial abuse, which." It seems like the conclusion. I talked to a bunch of different lawyers about this, Carl, and everybody thought this was at best a borderline move, but it was super aggressive and had real implications, and really sort of was, you know, an acceleration, a tipping point, whatever you want to call it. It took this whole thing to a different level, but in a direction that had nothing to do, so far as we know, with the original charge of the special counsel, which was Russia collusion. Last word.
Well, this has been the problem with special prosecutors all along. They have no budget, no budgetary restraints, no boss, and they can go wherever it goes. Now, if you're a law and order guy, you'd say, well, you know, these are prosecutors, FBI. If they come across evidence of wrongdoing, they can't really ignore it, and they shouldn't, even if it had nothing to do with it. I get that argument, but here you're going the president's lawyer. Why would anybody think that this is a legitimate thing if they're going to start leaking the stuff right away? Doesn't that undermine what they're saying? Because that's a crime. They're going in there, taking this evidence. It's either if it's Justice Department lawyers, they're violating the canon of ethics. If it's FBI gates, they're violating their own internal reviews. And in some cases, if any of the stuff's classified, I don't know it. If it is, they're violating the law. So that undermines the argument that these people are just following the law. They're not following the law.
All right.
They're using the law to hurt Republicans and to hurt the president. And if this was reversed and this was being done to Democrats, this is all you would hear about, Tom.
Yeah. All right, we've got to leave it there. Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief Executive Editor for Real Clear Politics. Thanks for joining me. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, Tom.
Okay. Take another quick break. When we get back, James Arkin, our congressional correspondent, will break down Paul Ryan's retirement. What does it mean? Why did he do it? And what does it mean for November and beyond? Stick around. We're going to be right back.
Alexa has some crazy skills, jokes, weather, and she plays WLS AM 890. Just ask her to enable the WLS skill or do it on your app.
And we are back. Tom Bevin with you. Joined on the phone now by James Arkin, our congressional correspondent, to discuss the exit of Paul Ryan. James, thanks for your time tonight. So how big of a deal? I mean, in one sense, this was not terribly surprising. Paul Ryan had sort of been giving off some signals that he was going to, you know, eventually call it quits. This is a tough job. It's a job that nobody wants, and they could barely convince him to do in the first place. And yet when it actually happened, when it came down, it was a bombshell. in the nation's capital and has set off a whole variety of things, not the least of which is a race to replace Paul Ryan. But how surprising was this, and what was the reaction like on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, it was. So I don't think it's particularly surprising to anyone on Capitol Hill or anyone who's been following Speaker Ryan that he will not be Speaker next year. But what was very surprising for Republicans and Democrats alike was the way that he decided to exit, announcing it, you know, 7 months before the midterm elections. I think Republicans were very, you know, upset about the announcement, very worried about what it meant for their midterms, the signal that it sent, and the way that it'll hurt Ryan's ability to help Republican candidates and Republican incumbents in the midterms. And I think a lot of people thought that if he was going to leave the speakership after this year, he would announce that in November after the midterm, whether or not Republicans held on to their majority. Very, very few people thought that he would announce that he was leaving in advance of the elections. It was a bombshell, and it was a real surprise.
You know, that seat has immediately gone from likely Republican to basically into toss-up territory. But you mentioned, you know, Ryan had been raising a lot of money for Republicans around the country. And I mean, is he going to now suddenly, is that all going away, or what's the plan? Is he still planning on campaigning on behalf of Republican candidates? I mean, what actual tangible impact will this have on Republicans' ability to hold the House in November?
Yeah, Ryan himself was actually a little bit defensive the day after his announcement, saying, look, I've raised a lot of money for House Republicans. I'm going to continue to do that. He has, you know, it was a concern when he decided to become Speaker that he was going to be able to fundraise and keep pace with John Boehner, his predecessor. And he has shattered all of the fundraising records for a Speaker of the House. But a lot of Republicans don't think it's going to last. They don't think that donors are going to be particularly interested in giving to a lame duck Speaker. They don't think that Ryan's going to be able to bring in as much as he was before this announcement. I mean, as you said, it's you know, the race to replace him is on between Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, the majority leader and whip in the Republican conference. And so some Republicans are hopeful that Scalise and McCarthy battling it out and trying to raise money to raise their profiles could make up for some of the shortfall that might not make its way to Paul Ryan. But we had a lot of Senate Republicans and strategists and even some donors arguing that this was going to turn folks' attention to the Senate and to keeping the Senate majority and kind of sent the signal that the House was maybe lost. And so I think a lot of Republican strategists and a lot of Republicans running this fall are really worried that Paul Ryan's money isn't going to be there the way it would have had he not made this announcement, and that McCarthy and Scalise just aren't going to be able to keep pace. I mean, remember, Ryan ran as a vice presidential candidate. He's got a big donor network. He raised a lot of money, and a lot of folks just don't think that he's going to be able to keep up that pace now that he's not sticking around.
So you mentioned this race to replace him, and you know, I read a handful of stories this week saying that, you know, there are some Republicans in Washington that are disgruntled that Ryan is staying around. They want him to leave now, leave the speakership now, get somebody else in there, so they can basically do exactly what you just said, sort of carry the banner heading into 2018. Ryan apparently does not want to do that. He's going to stick around. But is there a chance that we could see something happen between now, you know, in advance of the election, a change in Congress? Or is that just something that if Ryan says he doesn't want to do it, that's how it's going to be?
Yeah, I think if Ryan says he doesn't want to do it, that's probably how it's going to be. But it would take someone either, you know, I don't even know who it would be, whether it would be Kevin McCarthy, whether it would be President Trump, whether someone else would have to sit down Paul Ryan and say, this is a big problem for Republicans. We need you to leave early so that we can get this settled. Otherwise, it's going to cause a huge problem for us in November. You know, a 7 month leadership battle is pretty unprecedented. But Ryan was really adamant that he was going to stick around. So I don't think it's very likely that he'll change his mind. I don't think that there's anyone out there who could convince him to change his mind. And, you know, some allies of McCarthy, are, you know, who is seen as perhaps the heir apparent, are the ones who really want Ryan to leave early and kind of get this wrapped up quickly. But I don't know how vocal or how large that group is. So right now, I think the safe bet is that Paul Ryan is going to stick around for the rest of this year.
We're speaking with James Arkin, congressional correspondent for Real Clear Politics, talking about Paul Ryan, his retirement. what it means for Republicans in the short term. But also, James, how much of this had to do with Donald Trump? I mean, Ryan says it didn't, but, and you know, it was not an easy job. We know that. But there were these tensions between Ryan and the White House, as there have been between other Republicans in the White House. How much of this was because of that? How much of this was the fact that perhaps Ryan did think that they were going to lose the House and he didn't want to be involved in that? And how much of this really was just, and politicians say this all the time, I just want to spend more time with my family, which in his case, I actually believe, because, you know, he is a family guy. He didn't want to do this in the first place because it was going to take away from his family time. So how much of those things played into his decision?
Yeah, I do think that he's sincere in talking about his family. I mean, he's talked about, you know, his father's early death and his kids being around the same age he was when his father passed away. So I do think he's sincere in that. But you have to take the context of Donald Trump and the direction of the Republican Party and how it's shifted away from sort of this Ryan, you know, limited government conservatism towards more the party of Donald Trump. The difficulties of day-to-day dealing with, the president and the way that he has conducted himself and the tweets that Ryan's constantly being asked about and being asked to weigh in on, the investigations and that sort of thing. I think, like you said, Paul Ryan didn't want the job and, being asked about investigations and tweets and sort of the chaos from the White House makes it a much tougher job than it already was. So I have to imagine that all of that played a pretty significant factor in just kind of probably the exhaustion of the job and him just wanting to call it quits. And he would never say this, but I think a lot of Republicans read in his retirement a signal that they should be concerned about losing the House this fall, that he did not want to stick around to see the House majority go. Now, Paul Ryan would never say that, but a lot of Republicans feel that way, and it certainly sent that signal to people.
Just about a minute and a half left, James. You know, Ryan, on one hand, as he said, he's accomplished a lot since he's been there, and indeed this tax cut was sort of the capstone, but he had always talked about, you know, entitlement reform, right? He'd been pushing his budget. He really enjoyed being the chairman of the budget committee, and he wanted to push entitlement reform, and that was sort of dead on arrival as soon as Trump took office, because Trump had given no indication that that was going to be part of his agenda. So, I mean, I guess overall, how would you assess Paul Ryan's legacy as a legislator, as a speaker? Successful, not successful, incomplete? Where would you put him?
I think probably somewhere around incomplete. I mean, as you said, he got the tax cut law that was sort of the capstone of his speakership, but remember, the tax cuts that they passed is not even close to the, you know, overhaul of the tax code that Paul Ryan initially wanted and that they initially set out to do. It's sort of a very watered-down version of that. And you're right. He talked about entitlement reform, Social Security, Medicare, for his entire time in Congress and 20 years in Congress, and they haven't been able to get it done. And in fact, as you said, the party has moved away from that. His budgets were very unpopular when he started, and then they became very popular, and then now the party moved away again. So I think incomplete. I think he got some stuff done in a short speakership, but certainly not everything he set out to do, and it's certainly not the direction he thought it would go when he took the job in 2015.
All right, we've got to leave it there. James Arkin, congressional correspondent for Real Clear Politics, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we get back for our final segment, John Cass, to talk about Bruce Rauner, the column that he wrote, Can Rauner Get the Republican Party Put Back Together Again in Time for His Reelection Bid in November? We will talk to John about that after these words. I've got John Cass on the phone. He is a columnist extraordinaire for the Chicago Tribune and a good buddy, frequent guest of this program. Glad to have him back. John, thanks for your time.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. So, listen, I wanted to have you on to talk about the column that you wrote just the other day about Bruce Rauner and comparing him to a very famous fairy tale character, Humpty Dumpty, to see if he can put the Republican Party back together again. And it sounds like you spoke to Jeannie Ives, and she didn't look like she was all ready to hop in there and start picking up the pieces.
I don't think Jean Ives wants to be part of the unity, tableau. However, also, you know, you have this week State Senator Sam McCann might run as an independent, and from the 50th district, and that would also, you know, already Rauner's hurting, and that would really hurt him. He needs every vote he can get, and unlike the original Humpty Dumpty, or at least the Lewis Carroll Humpty Dumpty, Humpty Dumpty didn't break himself. He just fell. But in Illinois, I think there's a good argument to be made that Rauner has, you know, through by his ads against Gene Ives, broken the Republican Party. That'll be tough.
Well, so you mentioned, I mean, what is, I agree with you 100%. He needs every vote he can get. And that is right. So he's going to have to try and reunify this party. But so what's the plan? I mean, is there outreach going on, or is it just kind of like, you know, well, we'll see what happens, or they have to come around to us because I'm the only option. And besides, you know, if it's not me, it's J.B. Pritzker. I mean, what is the plan to, you know, you talk there about him offering some sort of apology, perhaps, but is that in the offing, or?
You know, he has some really talented people around him, Governor Rauner. One is Betsy Ankiel, who she ran Ron Johnson's campaign in Wisconsin, which wasn't an easy one, and she helped him win for the Senate. They're trying to put together, you know, meetings, private meetings with conservatives and activist groups, trying to convince them that they really don't have any other choice. And it seems like a decent strategy, but by and large, the margin of victory was so small for Rauner last time against Patrick Quinn, who was a hapless candidate. You know, he won by less than 4%. And Governor, I think there was a wise man named Tom Bevin on Fox News who was talking about, you're running for re-election and you can't get this, you know, even near 60 in a primary, let alone where was Rauner in this one? It was pathetic. You're going to have trouble, you know, and he's going to have trouble, serious trouble.
Yeah, I happen to think that, well, absent some sort, even, let me ask you this, John, would an apology, would that even be good enough because of the way that he's... Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it'd be enough. And I don't know what he can do beyond that. I mean, he's just, because his credibility has been, you know, sort of diminished.
You have to be careful on how you win a primary. You know, if you win a primary by basically assaulting your opponents to the point where they can't come back with you in the general, that's not a good strategy. And I think he really wanted, you know, there's an element of the Republican Party in Illinois that just hates the conservatives. And the conservatives in the Republican Party really loathes the establishmentarian. So I got a feeling that conservatives would rather just pull out, let the whole thing go to hell, and rebuild the party. You know, have it, if there's anything to rebuild, because most of the people leaving, there are two groups of people leaving furiously from Illinois. I'd say one is African-Americans, and that doesn't, you know, that's a difficult one, because if you're a Democrat and you're running for mayor, you want them here. And the other is the are conservatives with means. Middle-class conservative people are taking off.
Right. Well, I mean, the counterargument to that, too, though, John, what you said about Rauner, is he may not have won the primary had he not taken a blowtorch to Ives, right? He might have lost that. I mean, it was his only chance of survival, but it does end up putting you in a place that where you're left with very limited options for the general election.
What does the rest of the country think of when they see Rauner? Do they even care? I mean, you're involved in the, you know, running Real Clear Politics.
Yeah, I don't.
I'm just wondering what.
I think that
we're just flyover.
For the most part, no. Look, I think that the folks that I talk to who are political strategists and political right. pundits and whatnot in Washington, they always ask me, like, what's going on with Rauner? I mean, is it as bad as it seems from the outside? Because it doesn't look good. And you get these stories that he's the, you know, you get stories from National Review, for example, right? Writing an editorial. Or you get stories saying that, you know, he's the worst Republican governor in America or whatever the story is. It looks bad. And I always tell him it's every bit as bad as it's every bit as bad as they think it is. Well, I just don't understand the sort of, from a political standpoint, sort of the political malpractice of it. Makes no sense.
I don't understand why they, you know, you're talking about the ads against Gene Ives.
I'm talking about that. I'm talking about signing the, you know, abortion bill, taxpayer funding of that. I'm talking about sanctuary state. I'm talking about all of it.
Mm-hmm. Sanctuary state bills.
All of the things that led to Ives's candidacy in the first place.
Exactly. And now you're going to have, it looks, you know, every minute it looks closer that Sam McCann is going to run as an independent. He's a conservative. And I think that would be the death blow.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to wait and see, John. You never know. I mean, we could get something. JB is not, he's not the best candidate in the world.
He actually resembles an egg more than Rauner does. But yeah, and I should talk, right? I should talk the way I could. Yeah,
which fairy tale character is JB? If Rauner's Humpty Dumpty, you got to come up with a subsequent. I'm assigning you homework now.
I would. Is Mr. Belvedere a character? He's a character in. He would be Mike Boss Madigan's Mr. Belvedere. He'd bring tea or apples whenever Madigan wanted them. Okay. It's really screwed up. I got to move to Indiana. I'm staying.
You're staying?
Yeah, I'm not leaving.
You said you were moving.
Yeah, I know. I just flirt with the idea. But
aren't you getting like a tiny house in Gary or something?
In Rensselaer.
A Rensselaer.
Under the windmills where I drink cheap bourbon and scream at the politicians of Illinois. But I'd rather stay here. This is my home. I love
it. You get to tough it out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that makes one of us. I'm just kidding. All right, John. John Cass, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks so much, Tom.
All right. And that's going to do it for me, Tom Bevin, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics. I will see you back here next Sunday night. Everybody, have a great, great week.